I'm going to say something real controversial right now. You listen to the radio? You listen to Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in Peterborough, Ontario, Canada.
Say what?
Say what? It's Trent Radio, baby.
Listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwanang, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. We're listening to the music of Angelo Badalamenti from the soundtrack for Twin Peaks. And we're going to get into David Lynch a little later. But first, Martin Scorsese. For the following radio monologue performance, I have adapted Martin Scorsese's 2019 opinion piece published in the New York Times called "I Said Marvel Movies Aren't Cinema. Let Me Explain." And I'm calling this Scorsese's Soliloquy. For me, for the filmmakers I came to love and respect, for my friends who started making movies around the same time I did, cinema was about aesthetic, emotional, and spiritual revelation. It was about characters, the complexity of people and their contradictory and sometimes paradoxical natures, how they can hurt and love one another and suddenly come face to face with themselves. It was about confronting the unexpected on the screen and in life. It dramatized and interpreted the enlarging, the sense of what was possible in the art form. And that was the key for us. It was an art form. There was some debate about that then, so we stood up for cinema as an equal to literature, music, or dance. You could find art in many different places and in just as many forms in the work of directors like Sam Fuller, Ingmar Bergman, Gene Kelly, Kenneth Anger, Jean-Luc Godard, or Don Siegel. Or in the films of Alfred Hitchcock. I suppose you could say that Hitchcock was a franchise, or that he was our franchise. Every new Hitchcock picture was an event. To be in a packed house in one of the old theaters watching Rear Window was an extraordinary experience. The chemistry between the audience and the picture created an electrifying event. And certain Hitchcock films were also like theme parks. I'm thinking of Strangers on a Train, where the climax takes place on a merry-go-round at an amusement park, and Psycho, which I saw at the Midnight Show on its opening day, an experience I would never forget. People were surprised and thrilled, and they weren't disappointed. 60 or 70 years later, we're still watching those pictures and marveling at them. But is it the thrills and the shocks that we keep returning to? I don't think so. The set pieces in North by Northwest are stunning. Still, they would be nothing more than a succession of dynamic and elegant compositions and cuts without the painful emotions at the story's center or the absolute lostness of Cary Grant's character. The climax of Strangers on a Train is a feat, but what resonates now is the interplay between the two principal characters and Robert Walker's profoundly unsettling performance. Some say that Hitchcock's pictures had a sameness to them, and perhaps that's true. Hitchcock himself wondered about it. But the sameness of today's franchise pictures is something else, again. Many elements that define cinema as we know it are in Marvel pictures. What's not there is revelation, mystery, or genuine emotional danger. Nothing's at risk. They made the pictures to satisfy specific demands, designed as variations on a finite number of themes. They are sequels by name, but they are remakes in spirit. That's the nature of modern film franchises. They are market researched, audience tested, vetted, modified, re-vetted, and remodified until they're ready for consumption. Another way of putting it would be that they are everything that the films of Paul Thomas Anderson, Claire Denis, Spike Lee, Ari Aster, Catherine Bigelow, and Wes Anderson are not. I will see something new when I watch a movie by any of those filmmakers. They will take me to unexpected and unnameable areas of experience, expanding my sense of what is possible in telling stories with moving images and sounds. So, you might ask, what's my problem? Why not just let superhero films and other franchise films be? The reason is simple. In many places around this country, franchise films are now your primary choice if you want to see something on the big screen. It's a difficult time in film exhibitions. There are fewer independent theaters than ever. The equation has flipped, and streaming has become the primary delivery system. Still, I don't know a single filmmaker who doesn't want to design films for the big screen and audiences in theaters. And if you tell me it's simply a matter of supply and demand and giving people what they want, I don't see it this way. It's a chicken and egg issue. If people are given only one kind of thing and endlessly sell only one type of thing, of course they will want more of that one kind of thing. Today, that tension is gone, and there are some in the business with absolute indifference to the very question of art and an attitude toward the history of cinema that is both dismissive and proprietary. a lethal combination. The situation, sadly, is that we now have two separate fields: worldwide audiovisual entertainment and cinema. They still overlap occasionally, but that's becoming increasingly rare. They are using the financial dominance of one to marginalize and even belittle the existence of the other. For anyone who dreams of making movies or just starting, the situation is brutal and inhospitable to art. Simply saying those words fills me with terrible sadness. Is Martin Scorsese right about cinema dying? Well, that is the question, and that is the title of Thomas Flight's video. Thomas Flight is a video essayist, and you can look him up on YouTube. Thomas Flight says it depends on who you ask, right? But there's one thing that almost everyone agrees on. Things are changing. The industry has been changing over the last decade, but the rate of change has accelerated in the past few years. Franchise films went from occasional temporal features to theaters' dominant offerings. Let's listen to a clip from Thomas Flight's video.
Is cinema dying? It depends on who you ask, but there's one thing that almost everyone agrees on. Things are changing. I mean, things have been changing in the industry over the last decade, but the rate of change just accelerated in the past few years. Franchise films went from being the occasional tentpole features to the dominant offering in theaters, as big media companies discovered that projects attached to already established entities were far more financially successful than original ideas, a flood of remakes, sequels, reboots, and franchises flooded into theaters. Meanwhile, as ticket sales trended down, online streaming became dominant, Netflix rose to prominence, and while it begrudgingly gave in and crossed over into traditional distribution, releasing some of its films in theaters so it could qualify for Academy Awards, every other major studio or media company frantically and desperately crossed over into streaming distribution, racing to release their own streaming services. A company that used to just make computers and iPods now began producing Russo Brothers movies and Spielberg and J.J. Abrams television. The line between TV and film has also been blurring for a while, with some films starting to look more like TV, long stories with reoccurring characters drawn out over multiple episodes, and many TV shows starting to look more like films broken into smaller pieces. The way we consume media has changed dramatically. There used to be the cinema and your television as ways you could watch something, but now there are theaters, TVs, tablets, computers, and phones. In the midst of all this change, the pandemic hits. Theaters shut down, the big moneymakers for many companies were essentially halted. Meanwhile, Netflix continued business as usual and exceeded growth expectations in 2020. Late in the year, after the one film Warner Brothers dared to release in theaters failed to bring in numbers, the studio announced that they'd release films in theaters and on their streaming service HBO Max simultaneously throughout 2021, a move that, for better or worse, will likely have historical impact on the film industry, and one that seriously upset filmmakers like Denis Villeneuve and ultimately led to Christopher Nolan breaking off his long-term relationship with the studio. In the midst of all of this sits Martin Scorsese, a 78-year-old director, someone who's been alive for half of cinema's short history as an art form. He's directed 24 feature films, almost as many documentaries, and in the process, he hasn't resisted technological progress in his own work, embracing digital cameras, CGI, producing television, and releasing his latest film on Netflix.
What streaming means and how that's going to define a new form of cinema, I'm not sure.
He's not someone you could call a Luddite or unwilling to change.
I think it's not just an evolving of cinema, but it's a revolution.
And yet from his perspective, something he loves dearly, the thing Martin Scorsese calls cinema, looks to be in danger of extinction.
But I'm also concerned. I'm almost very concerned.
Is he right?
Is cinema dying? Well, what is cinema? Martin Scorsese writes in Harper's Magazine that cinema is really close to what Fellini does in movies. Let's listen to more of Thomas Flight in defining what is cinema, but I'm going to remix it a little bit with some music. Just improvise this right now. So hang on.
But here's the thing. That thing Scorsese is talking about, even if it is distinct, is cinema really the right word for it? Here I'm not really sure. On one hand, I think using the term and labeling Marvel films not cinema probably makes Scorsese's point a little more controversial than it needs to be, making it sound like he's making a quality judgment rather than a descriptive one. But on the other hand, what else would you call it? What better word is there to make this distinction? I'm not sure, but no matter what you label it, the experience I described above, the one Scorsese labels cinema, that specific thing does seem to be dying, or at least significantly diminishing in cultural influence. But this is where I'm conflicted. Cinema, especially as it involves the communal, theatrical experience, might be at the beginning of a slow death. But if you're interested in the art of moving images and the rich, unique stories being told with them, apart from that communal, theatrical experience, it's maybe the best time to be alive. For anyone who is interested in the art form of cinema and film history, there's now, for most people, actually the possibility of access to an unparalleled selection of films and film history. In the era Scorsese came up in, when he was watching 8 and a Half, it was before home video was even widely available. At that time, you were reliant on theaters in your city or town to find and curate films for you. And unless you had the extravagant resources to collect 35mm film prints or access to a library of prints, much of film history would have been completely inaccessible to you. These days, with a subscription to a few streaming services, you can have access to more great cinema than you would ever have time to conceivably watch. And in a way, it's the same technology that is killing cinema that's making this possible. You may not be able to have as many experiences in theaters in the same way Scorsese did, and that's certainly sad, but the trade-off so far has meant unparalleled access to a world of cinema for those who are interested. But there are also downsides to this new availability. The cultural influence of moving image entertainment as a whole, whether it's movies, TV, YouTube videos, or TikToks, is at an all-time high, and in a way, the real struggle for Scorsese's cinema is not even to differentiate itself from Marvel-type films, it's to even be able to differentiate itself from any kind of moving image entertainment in this vast world of content. We are surrounded by a torrent of moving images. It is inescapably part of our cultural language. Fellini's 8 and a Half, a 4-hour movie that wasn't shown in theaters, a TV show that's 90 minutes in length, a web series that's now a TV show, a new indie film, a blockbuster release, and for that matter, a video of your friend on vacation or me talking to you right now all get lumped together into a giant bin we call content. Film critic Matt Zoller-Seitz says in an article addressing this issue, content refers to a piece of entertainment that can be delivered any number of ways, and that's defined less by its story, characters, source material, or presentational medium, cinema or TV, than by its brand identity, Marvel, its corporate parentage, Disney, and its ability to get hundreds of millions of people talking about it all at once. To distill all moving images down to content, I think is to value them only for what they provide to the companies that serve them to us. Something to be traded for subscription dollars, or a way to grab your attention to trade it for advertising dollars.
Yeah, moviegoers are better defined today as movie watchers. You know, a lot of that movie watching now mostly happens at home. That's just the way it is. Okay.
I think treating everything as content divorces the viewer from the person creating the content and what they have to say.
Hence, I feel it's kind of becoming more and more tailored towards a consumer experience, because movies are, they're slotted into consumer categories before they're even given a chance to breathe.
It turns the viewer from someone participating in an artistic expression to just a passive consumer of entertainment or a product.
It turns the viewer from someone participating in an artistic expression to just a passive consumer of entertainment or a product. That was Thomas Flight. We're listening to the work of Lobo Sono, Cinematique, Volume 1. For a complete playlist, check the show notes. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio, 92.7 CFFF FM, in beautiful Nagajiwanong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. In the recent film Lynch / Oz 2023, a film about the influence of The Wizard of Oz on David Lynch's work, investigates what totems and themes and motifs he regurgitates because they've become, quote, embedded in his own cultural lexicon. Director Alexandre O'Philippe divided the feature-length essay film into 6 chapters, each hosted by a different perspective on the same subject. The last, David Lowery admits that as a filmmaker, he does that as well. His thoughts have profoundly affected how I started to think about my own work. Lowry says that in directing Pete's Dragon, for example, he was recapitulating Spielberg's signature camera move each time he dollied into a close-up of an actor's face. He says that look has embedded itself in his psyche throughout the years of loving Spielberg films. Putting together a list of movies that I think have a seismic effect on my work, he says, it's not a long list. He counts among them the first movies he saw in the movie theater, Disney's Pinocchio from 1940 and Spielberg's E.T. 82. Those impressions run deep and are hard to escape, says Lowry. They're so hard to escape that I think the majority of us storytellers don't try to escape them. We just dig in deeper. He says we repeatedly make the same movie and tell the same story. Lowry thinks David Lynch's Lost Highway was a step towards Mulholland Drive, which led to Inland Empire and further evolved to Twin Peaks, The Return. He says once you realize what you're digging towards, you can appreciate their body of work in a new light. Because you understand what matters to them, Lowry said. I love the idea of digging in deeper and hitting the boundaries within the work that we've created for ourselves, rather than trying to expand the horizons around us. I like the comfort of knowing that there's always further inward. The themes and images that compel us are the ones we will keep revisiting, re-exploring, reinvestigating, recontextualizing, and re-everything, because they are the things that compel us to be storytellers in the first place. We look to the past while looking into the future, which is valuable for our culture. Listening to Laura Palmer's theme by Angelo Badalamenti from the Twin Peaks soundtrack. Let's listen to Colin Stetson.
Thank you.
Mamoru Oshii, anime director, said, I start by referencing films I've seen recently or back in the day. It's just a matter of course. Is it inspiration or copying? Same thing. Creative arts are like that. All cinematic creativity is quotational. But it is different from exact copying, in that quotation means you run it through your own interior, thus editing it. You change the meaning, the nuance, the arrangement, and so on, so you'll naturally see traces of me pop up here and there. Sometimes I wonder if originality as such even exists. How you handle the quotes and whether you're good or bad at doing it matters. How do you use them, and what is your unique twist? What is your intent in quoting? Therein lies what we call individuality or authorship. Working as a director helped me grasp something like the core of this. I think it's safe to say that it was Blade Runner. It proved what I was thinking. It was telling me it was all right to do that. You're doing the right thing. Just do it fearlessly. But what does that really mean? Though I've changed, I wasn't concerned with the plot or the drama back then. I was concerned with the setting and the vision. I wanted to develop a mind-blowing worldviews. People won't remember the film's plot, I thought. The actor or the director's name. It's all in the details. And Blade Runner is a mass of information. That's what Mamoru Oshii said about how films are quotational. In A is for Alice, writer Carol Maver highlights Chris Marker's words from In Memory. He said, I want to claim for the image the humility and powers of a Madeline. Chris Marker wanted to create an image that stirs a memory. Maver writes, like Proust, Jetman, the hero of La Jetée, follows his Madeline. The scallop shell-shaped cake with the taste that unlocked the door to the past connects to Hitchcock's Vertigo, which Marker noted also in Memory deals with the extravagant quest to rediscover things past. That is, its heroine just happens to be called Madeline, is the kind of fluke that connoisseurs can smile over with exaggerating its importance. Mostly told through still photographs, La Jetée seems to be about the power of images themselves. The film begins with the line, this is the story of a man marked by an image from his childhood. Or you could say bruised by an image from his childhood. What images have bruised me? What about those Filipino movies I grew up with? Are they still inaccessible on today's internet? Can I find Darna and Dolphy on YouTube? One of the most precise first movie images I remember is a shot of a man standing under the heart of a banana tree with his mouth wide open and tongue out, waiting for the dew to drop from the hanging bud at midnight. What images have bruised me? What is my rosebud? when I look back at the foundational texts from which I learned the grammar of filmmaking, I can't discount the importance of Sesame Street for teaching me the language of experimental cinema at an early age. It would be so much fun now to show clips from Sesame Street in split screen comparisons with the avant-garde, well-known early experimental films like Ballet Mécanique from 1924, directed by Dudley Murphy and Fernand Léger, or Anemic Cinema from 1926, directed by Marcel Duchamp, and more. There could be a whole chapter on Sesame Street. Thomas Flight says, we teach literacy, grammar, and spelling in school, and still, while the average person spends much more time watching moving images than reading or writing, the idea of visual literacy as something worth recognizing the existence of, much less teaching, is often scoffed at and ridiculed as pretentious. In defense of experimental filmmakers, essayist Thomas Flight says that people trying to find the extreme boundaries of what a medium is capable of need some pretense to their work. It's the imagining that the form can do something more. They're testing it, breaking it, and discovering new, exciting territory in the medium, he says. And some of us might enjoy going on that journey with these artists, and others might not. Nonetheless, he points out that all of us have benefited from the pioneers at the fringes who have often been discovering the techniques that work their way into the mainstream filmmaking as part of the everyday narrative toolkit that audiences come to accept. Thomas Flight explains that in the 1920s, Soviet filmmakers were placing a lot of emphasis on the simple power of juxtaposing images to communicate ideas. Filmmakers like Sergei Eisenstein saw film's primary language as a poetic and visual one constructed through the connection of images and editing. Flight visually illustrates the direct connection of a film like Man with a Movie Camera from 1929 to Koyaanisqatsi 1982 and other nonverbal documentaries, which are often, quote, devoid of traditional narrative. And these films can help us understand the power, he says, that images alone have to convey ideas. Flight says, when we know that power, we understand the full depth cinema can offer. And for documentaries, usually shot without scripts, the editor gains an even greater significance as a storyteller in shaping and crafting the story from mountains of gathered footage. The documentary is less of a genre and more of a creative practice and an approach to form. One where, more often than not, the story must be discovered on location and the editing room instead of created. We're listening to the work of Colin Stetson, the original motion picture soundtrack from the film La Peur. For video essayist Thomas Flight, Experimental films reveal the power available to filmmakers as storytellers simply by removing or changing the context surrounding an image, or crafting a narrative by connecting images. These films can tell stories that are global or cosmic in scale, delve into the architecture of memory, or explore the very nature of what we mean when we say something is true.
Jean-Luc Godard's explosive debut, Breathless, is often most characterized by its unwillingness to conform to cinematic convention. Godard was essentially rewriting the rules of film as he was making his own. This freeform technique was viewed as liberating. Cinema no longer had to be restricted by what was seen as dogmatic principles. Although viewed now as revolutionary, Godard didn't know whether or not this technique would work. He was, one could say, experimenting.
Allez vous faire foutre.
Carl Theodor Dreyer, when creating The Passion of Joan of Arc, created a film that, even during the silent era, was perceived as silent. A completely silent film, devoid of all music, as Dreyer opted to prioritize close-ups in his cinematography. A film almost entirely reliant on the solemnity and intensity of the actor's performance was a completely unconventional approach, which many would refer to in retrospect as experimental. Two films completely separate from one another considered experimentations of their form, and yet there remains a defined genre that these two pieces wouldn't qualify for categorization. That genre is experimental film. And it's a genre of film that we don't even particularly associate with cinema. Why? Well, the answer is immediately recognized by anyone watching experimental films. They're simply too different. They're too esoteric and too impenetrable. They're seemingly about nothing. Yet at the same time, these abstract effigies possess an allure to them, as though beneath their strange exterior, there's something to be discovered. Perhaps not all of them, but surely there's something to be found here. If we can enjoy cinema that deviates from all manner of tradition, then where is the line drawn to where cinema ends and the experiment begins? If we go back to cinema's primordial soup, we could argue that every film was experimental. Filmmakers, in the very act of their profession, we're attempting to decipher the mystery of this almost magical new piece of technology. Everything they did was without a pre-established rule. But even in the days of early and silent cinema, we can still find something in film outsider to cinema. The work of Hans Richter begins one of the more notable deviations from the trend of cinematic convention that had been established by the 1920s. The most obvious omission from his work is the lack of a basic narration. In his Rhythmus series, the anti-cinematic obsession with geometric objects indicates that there is no subject to the piece. And in the simple interplay of shapes, Richter tells us that in a movie, everything becomes an object, a symbol, a storytelling device. Thus, you can put anything in the frame, and some story will emerge. Thank you. In essence, the meaning being that there is no meaning at all. And although Hans Richter is often the most well-known and experimental of the avant-garde filmmakers of this era, he didn't invent this notion. Walter Ruttmann's Lichtspiel opus was already exploring the interplay of light and composition in its most abstract format. The idea that emerges time and time again was that film was a new language. This didn't necessarily mean the complete eschewal of all narrative, but what was the cinematic imagery that dictated its meter? How does one convey the poetry of the moving image? This was the nature of Giga Vertov's explorations in Man with a Movie Camera. Experimental film is always searching for the secrets hidden within the images of film and finding the methods of how to reveal them, through montage, composition, mise-en-scène, and of course, the camera itself. For many decades throughout cinema, this has been a major tenet of experimental film, the meta-awareness of the camera. We can trace this all the way back to James Williamson's The Big Swallow, in which a subject swallows the camera, devouring the director himself, all the while the film continues, having never truly reached the point of absolute objectivity in cinema, as such a thing seems impossible. And since then, this fascination has been the sandbox for artists to play around in. Deciphering the syntax of the camera precedes any classical storytelling.
We're listening to Bernard Herrmann, his classic film music for Vertigo. Before that, we were listening to Cinema Cartography, another video essayist from YouTube, talking about experimental film. Check out the links in the show notes for the complete playlist. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio, 92.7 CFFF FM, in beautiful Nagajiwanang, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. I'll leave you with some Julie Cruz from Into the Night. Songs inspired by David Lynch's Twin Peaks. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back next week.